I am Lara on WNYC, and my next guest, Marilyn Mosby, is the state's attorney for the city of Baltimore. In 2014, she was elected the youngest top prosecutor of a major city at the age of 35. The next year, she became a national figure after charging six Baltimore police officers with the alleged murder of 25-year-old Freddie Gray after he died in police custody, but none of the officers were convicted. Ms. Mosby is in town today to deliver the keynote address at the Trust and Transparency Symposium hosted by the New York City Civilian Complaint Review Board. Her visit happens to coincide with the release of a major New York Times ProPublica article about Baltimore's struggle to control rising crime rates, very unlike New York, and institute police reform at the same time. Ms. Mosby, it's very nice to have you in our studio. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me, Brian.
Can you begin with the speech you're going to give today? What's the message you'll deliver to the New York City Civilian Complaint Review Board, which, as its name suggests, deals with civilian complaints about police behavior?
So I'm extremely excited. I think that what you all have here in New York, the Civilian Complaint Review Board, you know, is an agency of the City of New York, independent of the NYPD, all civilian form, which investigates and mediates and prosecutes complaints of misconduct among four jurisdictional sort of categories: force, abuse of authority, discourtesy, and offensive language. And I'm going to just impress upon the importance of transparency and trust and building confidence in the community, especially around, you know, oversight and police accountability.
How much is transparency about police behavior something you feel is unfinished business?
So it's incredibly important. You know, one of the things that I've learned kind of the hard way is that, you know, you have to be, in order to build that confidence, you have to be transparent in all of your actions. And that's really what the community is looking for. You know, one of the things that we do in my office, we follow the standards of the Association of Prosecuting Attorneys and 21st century best prosecution models, in which we publish, you know, when it comes to police-involved deaths and shootings, we publish our declinations. If we decline to charge police officers, we provide a rationale and justification, a PowerPoint presentation, and essentially put that on our website so that people know what is going on. You know, at the end of the day, we have to be able to build trust. And the reason why is because the criminal justice system relies on the community.
And that's with respect to your office. Anything in particular you'd say with respect to police? Like, we have a controversy in New York right now over whether police disciplinary records should be public records. Anything in particular where you think the police need to improve in transparency?
So again, this is something that we struggle with in Baltimore. This is not just something that's exclusive to New York, but it is incredibly important for that level of transparency. You know, when there are complaints, when there are issues among an IA record, I think that that should be accessible. It should be accessible to the public. It should be something that people know about.
Have you read the Times and ProPublica article or any summary of it yet?
No, I have not. I have not.
One thing the article does is to say that people in cities like New York that used to be high crime and are now low crime have no idea how different a place like Baltimore is. Baltimore, which it says was headed in that direction. And it implies that, you know, beware, New York, if we make the same mistakes as Baltimore. Doesn't say this, but it's sort of between the lines. The same reversal can happen here. And I know it's complicated, but can you take a minute or two and describe why you think New York and Baltimore have been headed in opposite directions in recent years on violent crime?
So, I mean, when you look at a place like New York and you look at a place like Baltimore, I think it's really incredibly important for folks to think about the root causes as to why crimes take place. So you look at, you know, the demographics in New York, and it's very diverse. But when we talk about the poverty, the concentration of poverty in New York and in Baltimore, it's very different. 24% of Baltimore's population lives in poverty. 35% of children live below poverty. There are over 18,000 vacant houses, 16,000 vacant lots. The unemployment rate for young African-American men between the ages of 18 and 24, which is more than twice as high than that of whites. When you look at the household median income of African-American families in the city of Baltimore, it's more than twice as low than that of whites. And so when you talk about that level and that sort of concentration of poverty, that's the difference between a city like Baltimore and New York. And so you have to ensure that you're not just divesting in these communities in West Baltimore, right?
But even in that context, crime was going down and now it's going up.
And we've had a lot going on. And I can tell you the past 4 years, I'll just say a few, you know, from the uprising and after the following the untimely death of Freddie Gray, you know, to the Department of Justice coming in and exposing the discriminatory policing practices of the eighth largest police department in the country, to the full implementation of body-worn cameras on all officers, where officers began to reenact the discovery and seizure of evidence and not placing it in the statement of probable cause, to having to review my office, having to review thousands of cases and filing hundreds of motions following one of the largest police corruption scandals in the history of this country, where you had a gun trace task force, a division of detectives that were putting ski masks over their face and robbing drug dealers and targeting African-American men with backpacks and planting guns in evidence. So when we talk about all of these other and the fact that I've had to work with five police commissioners in the past 3 years to somehow relegate that to, you know, this is crime was going down before. We've had an unprecedented level of challenges and hurdles that we've had to overcome as a city.
I'm curious your impression of the effects of the consent decree that you mentioned. For people in our area who don't know, the Freddie Gray officers were not convicted, but the U.S. Justice Department mm-hmm. found systemic racial discrimination, including a pattern of excessive use of force, and Baltimore had to enter into a consent decree with the federal government. Has that consent decree produced meaningful reform, in your opinion?
I think it's going to produce meaningful reform. And when we think about this, you know, everybody wants to tie this back to the untimely death of Freddie Gray. And as I stated, I haven't read that article. But I can tell you that when we think about that accountability, right, 2015, that accountability where you're applying one standard of justice to everyone, regardless of sex, regardless of religion, regardless of occupation, that was not being had in this country. We applied one standard of justice. And because of that accountability ultimately led to exposure. As you stated, a week after I charged those officers, the Department of Justice came in, exposed the discriminatory policing practices of the eighth largest police department in the country. And because of that exposure, we now have reform. We have a federally enforceable consent decree that even despite the Trump administration that tried to forestall it is still on record.
That was going to be my next question. Has the Trump administration, once they came back, and we know Jeff Sessions, the original attorney general, right. was no fan of these consent decrees, have they pulled back in a way that has let the Baltimore PD off the hook?
No, they attempted to. But they were unsuccessful. The community stepped forward and said, absolutely not. And so when you think about the fact that, you know, those six officers that we charged, and we had more than probable cause to believe that they committed these offenses. This was an innocent 25-year-old black man by the name of Freddie Carlos Gray Jr., who was made eye contact with police, who was unconstitutionally arrested, who was placed into a metal wagon, head first, feet shackled and handcuffed. His spine was partially severed in the back of that wagon, and his pleas for medical attention were subsequently ignored. I followed the facts with the law and I wouldn't do anything differently. But when you consider the fact that those six officers weren't held individually and criminally responsible, when you think of the fact that every single police officer is now being held accountable for the actions of a few, I went into this to reform the criminal justice system, and I can say that we successfully did that in 18 months.
I want to ask you about the politics and media reaction to high crime in Baltimore. This is one last quote from the ProPublica New York Times article, because it's partly about, you know, the politics of this. And it says, on right-wing talk radio, one of the few sectors of the media to take much interest in Baltimore's crime surge, there are old tropes of urban mayhem. On the left, in contrast, Baltimore's recent woes have been largely overlooked, partly because they present a challenge to those who start from the assumption that policing is inherently suspect. What would you say to that political analysis of what you're subject to?
So, I mean, in any city, you're subject to this political sort of right and left sort of theology. And what I would just say is that when you look at my city, Freddie Gray was one of 40 to 50,000 cases we prosecute in the city of Baltimore a year. And despite all of those external challenges, those unprecedented challenges that we just previously discussed, we still, in my office, have attempted to be the stability within that city. We've attempted to ensure that we're still convicting folks and we're doing our job. Last year, we had a 97% conviction rate, right? But the problem that I have as the prosecutor is what I'm addressing today. It's that community sort of cooperation. We cannot do our job. And let me just say, the majority of police officers in Baltimore City are hardworking, dedicated police officers who are risking their lives each and every day for their community. I come from four generations of police officers. My grandfather was the founding member of the first Black police organization in Massachusetts. I understand, I appreciate, and respect the profession. But we have to also understand that police can't do this by themselves. You know, for far too long, prosecutors have only taken a reactionary sort of approach to prosecution. They haven't been proactive. And that's what we have to be able to do in a city like Baltimore.
So on being proactive, we've gotten calls on this show from police officers or retired officers in the New York area. And it's a national conversation, certainly includes Baltimore, about it. In the current political climate, police officers being too passive because they're afraid of baseless prosecutions for doing their jobs. Is that a problem?
So, and I would say it shouldn't be a problem. At the end of the day, if you're going to do your job and exercise your authority within the confines of the Constitution, which you're required to do, right? It shouldn't necessitate you feeling like you're going to be prosecuted. Like, at the end of the day, we want good policing, and the majority of the police officers I can say and I can attest to in Baltimore are doing that.
Recently, you announced that you will no longer prosecute marijuana cases and announced you would seek to vacate 5,000, I think the number is, prior marijuana convictions. Of course, there are movements like this going on around the country.
Yeah.
Tell us the Baltimore version.
Yeah, and I can just say, you know, the precedence was set with Cy Vance and Eric Gonzalez right here in Brooklyn. But you know, and I think it's pretty much known nationally that when it comes to the prosecution of marijuana, there's no public safety value in prosecuting marijuana. It disproportionately impacts communities of color, which contribute and exacerbate that erosion of public trust, and is costly and counterproductive to the limited resources that we have as law enforcement. When you look at my city, where last year we had 316 homicides with a year-end clearance rate of only 26%, I don't want to utilize my limited resources, right, and going after an individual for smoking marijuana when we should be utilizing, you know, the crime lab and fingerprint analysis and, you know, the discovery process and going to trial on individuals that are committing heinous murders. You know, that's what makes sense when it comes from a resource perspective. The most problematic issue for me in the prosecution of this is that when you look at the disparate impact that it is having on poor communities of color. Since the decriminalization, even before the decriminalization, we knew that nationally, as a Black man, you're four times more likely to be arrested for possession of marijuana. But since the decriminalization of marijuana in the city of Baltimore in 2014, you now issue civil citations. And if you don't have an identification, you're still arrested, right? But they have still only targeted poor Black and brown communities. So that in 2015, the citations that were issued, 89% were Black. 2016, 94% were issued to Black people. 2017, 95% were issued to Black people. And the most staggering statistic is that of those citations that were issued, right, out of 42% of them came and were issued in one out of nine police districts, which happens to be the Western District, where I live, where the uprising took place, and where that community is disproportionately impoverished and 95% Black.
And we have the same thing in New York, the same disparities, the same problem, where those, despite the Cy Vance and Eric Gonzalez reforms, people are still being arrested in some meaningful numbers, largely because if they get given a summons for marijuana possession or smoking in public, whatever, whatever, then their records get checked. And if they have any other kind of outstanding violations, they may be taken in, which has helped fuel the debate in New York. And they're fairly close in Albany. I don't know if they're going to get there this year, but to full legalization. Do you support full legalization of marijuana?
So, and I think it's important for us to note that the consumption of marijuana among white and black people are the same, right? It's the discriminatory enforcement of these laws that I am opposed to. And yes, I do support the full legalization of marijuana. Again, as the prosecutor, I can never be complicit in the discriminatory enforcement of laws against poor black and brown people. And that's essentially what I've stated in my policy.
Last thing. And it really relates to national politics, tangentially to Kamala Harris's presidential run, and to reform-minded prosecutors all over the country. We're in an era of progressive prosecutors, the ones here you cited yourself, interested in reducing unnecessary incarceration and police use of force, as well as fighting crime. But some argue that the idea of progressive prosecutor has serious limits, specifically that prosecutors need good relationships with the police so much that it's too much to be real advocates, never mind enforcers of reform. How do you deal with that perception or those competing interests?
So I think that when you look at the awesome amount of discretion that prosecutors have, we do have to be those change agents for the criminal justice system. And this is something where we are the ones who decide. We are the gatekeepers to the criminal justice system. We decide who's going to be charged, what they're going to be charged with, what sentence recommendations they're going to make. We make a determination as to whether or not an individual even gets into the system in the first place. It is an incredibly vital role in the criminal justice system, but it's also an independent office of the police department. So we work very much together with the police department. I have a 97% conviction rate. We would not have that without our codependence and, you know, our relationship and rapport with the police. But it's also our mission is to apply one standard of justice to all, regardless of who you are, what you look like, what sex you may be, and what occupation you may be. And so this idea that we cannot do our job because we have to work with the police is just absurd.
Marilyn Mosby, the state's attorney for Baltimore. She is in town today to deliver the keynote address at the Trust and Transparency Symposium hosted by the New York City Civilian Complaint Review Board. And the public is invited to this. This is in about 2 hours from now. It's at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and it's at 12:45. And again, this event is free and open to the public. And Ms. Mosby, we thank you so much for making this one of your stops on the way there. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Brian. I really appreciate it.